Chapter 40. Bridge, and refused to rise. P put an end to me at once, he repeated in a stifled voice. Satillo had to interfere. The uproar and confusion on the bridge became so great that the helmsman fled from the wheel. He took refuge in the engine room and alarmed the engineers, who, disregarding the threats of the soldiers set on guard over them, stopped the engines, protesting that they would rather be shot than run the risk of being drowned down below. This was the first time Nostromo and Deckard heard the steamer stop. After order had been restored, and the binnacle lamp relighted, she went ahead again, passing wide of the lighter in her search for the Isabels. The group could not be made out, and, at the pitiful entreaties of the captain, Satillo allowed the engines to be stopped again, to wait for one of those periodical lightnings of darkness caused by the shifting of the cloud canopy spread above the waters of the gulf. Satillo, on the bridge, muttered from time to time angrily to the captain. The other, in an apologetic and cringing tone, begged Somerset the colonel to take into consideration the limitations put upon human faculties by the darkness of the night. Satillo swelled with rage and impatience. It was the chance of a lifetime. If your eyes are of no more use to you than this, I shall have them put out, he yelled. The captain of the steamer made no answer, for just then the mass of the Great Isabel loomed up darkly after a passing shower, then vanished, as if swept away by a wave of greater obscurity preceding another downpour. This was enough for him. In the voice of a man, come back to life again, he informed Satillo that in an hour he would be alongside the Sulaco wharf. The ship was put then full speed on the course, and a great bustle of preparation for landing arose among the soldiers on her deck. It was heard distinctly by Deckard and Nostromo. The captains understood its meaning. They had made out the Isabels, and were going on now in a straight line for Sulaco. He judged that they would pass close, but believed that lying still like this, with the sail lowered, the lighter could not be seen. And no, not even if they rubbed sides with us, he muttered. The rain began to fall again, first like a wet mist, then with a heavier touch, thickening into a smart perpendicular downpour, and the hiss and thump of the approaching steamer was coming extremely near. Deckard, with his eyes full of water and lowered head, asked himself how long it would be before she drew past, when unexpectedly he felt a lurch. An inrush of foam broke swishing over the stern, simultaneously with a crack of timbers and a staggering shock. He had the impression of an angry hand laying hold of the lighter and dragging it along to destruction. The shock, of course, had knocked him down, and he found himself rolling in a lot of water at the bottom of the lighter. A violent churning went on alongside. A strange and amazed voice cried out something above him in the night. He heard a piercing shriek for help from Senior Hirsch. He kept his teeth hard set all the time. It was a collision. The steamer had struck the lighter obliquely, heeling her over till she was half swamped, starting some of her timbers, and swinging her head parallel to her own course with the force of the blow. The shock of it on board of her was hardly perceptible. All the violence of that collision was, as usual, felt only on board the smaller craft. Even Nostromo himself thought that this was perhaps the end of his desperate adventure. He, too, had been flung away from the long tiller, which took charge in the lurch. Next moment the steamer would have passed on, leaving the lighter to sink or swim after having shouldered her thus out of her way, and without even getting a glimpse of her form, had it not been that, being deeply laden with stores and the great number of people on board, her anchor was low enough to hook itself into one of the wire shrouds of the lighter's mast. For the space of two or three gasping breaths, that new rope held against the sudden strain. It was this that gave Deckard the sensation of the snatching pull, dragging the lighter away to destruction. The cause of it, of course, was inexplicable to him. The whole thing was so sudden that he had no time to think. But all his sensations were perfectly clear. He had kept complete possession of himself, In fact, he was even pleasantly aware of that calmness at the very moment of being pitched headfirst over the transom, to struggle on his back in a lot of water. Senor Hirsch's shriek he had heard and recognized, while he was regaining his feet, all was with that mysterious sensation of being dragged headlong through the darkness. Not a word, not a cry escaped him. He had no time to see anything. And following upon the despairing screams for help, the dragging motion ceased so suddenly that he staggered forward with open arms and fell against the pile of the treasure boxes. He clung to them instinctively, in the vague apprehension of being flung about again, and immediately he heard another lot of shrieks for help, prolonged and despairing, not near him at all, but unaccountably in the distance, away from the lighter altogether, as if some spirit in the night were mocking at Senor Hirsch's terror and despair. Then all was still as when you wake up in your bed in a dark room from a bizarre and agitated dream. The lighter rocked slightly. The rain was still falling. Two groping hands took hold of his bruised sides from behind, and the Capataz's voice whispered, in his ear, "Silence, for your life! Silence!" The steamer has stopped. Deckard listened. The gulf was dumb. He felt the water nearly up to his knees. "Are we sinking?" he asked in a faint breath. "I don't know," Nostromo breathed back to him. "Einar, make not the slightest sound." Hirsch, when ordered forward by Nostromo, had not returned into his first hiding place. He had fallen near the mast, and had no strength to rise. Moreover, he feared to move. He had given himself up for dead, but not on any rational grounds. It was simply a cruel and terrifying feeling. Whenever he tried to think what would become of him, his teeth would start chattering violently. He was too absorbed in the utter misery of his fear to take notice of anything. Though he was stifling under the lighter sail which Nostromo had unwittingly lowered on top of him, he did not even dare to put out his head till the very moment of the steamer striking. Then, indeed, he leaped right out, spurred on to new miracles of bodily vigor by this new shape of danger. The inrush of water, when the lighter heeled over, unsealed his lips. His shriek, "Save me," was the first distinct warning of the collision for the people on board the steamer. Next moment the wire shroud parted, and the released anchor swept over the lighter's forecastle. It came against the breast of Senor Hirsch, who simply seized hold of it, without in the least knowing what it was, but curling his arms and legs upon the part above the fluke with an invincible, unreasonable tenacity. The lighter yawed off wide, and the steamer, moving on, carried him away, clinging hard, and shouting for help. It was some time, however, after the steamer had stopped, that his position was discovered. His sustained yelping for help seemed to come from somebody swimming in the water. At last a couple of men went over the bows and hauled him on board. He was carried straight off to Sotillo on the bridge. His examination confirmed the impression that some craft had been run over and sunk, but it was impracticable on such a dark night to look for the positive proof of floating wreckage. Sotillo was more anxious than ever now to enter the harbor without loss of time. The idea that he had destroyed the principal object of his expedition was too intolerable to be accepted. This feeling made the story he had heard appear the more incredible. Senor Hirsch, after being beaten a little for telling lies, was thrust into the chart room. But he was beaten only a little. His tale had taken the heart out of Sotillo's staff, though they all repeated round their chief, "Impossible, impossible," with the exception of the old major, who triumphed gloomily. I told you," he mumbled. I could smell some treachery, some diableria a league off." Meantime, the steamer had kept on her way towards Sulaco, where only the truth of that matter could be ascertained. Deckard and Nostromo heard the loud churning of her propeller diminish and die out, and then, with no useless words, busied themselves in making for the Isabels. The last shower had brought with it a gentle but steady breeze. The danger was not over yet, and there was no time for talk. The lighter was leaking like a sieve. They splashed in the water at every step. The cap is put into Deckard's hands, the handle of the pump which was fitted at the side aft, and at once, without question or remark, Deckard began to pump in utter forgetfulness of every desire, but that of keeping the treasure afloat. Nostromo hoisted the sail, flew back to the tiller, pulled at the sheet like mad. The short flare of a match they had been kept dry in a tight tin box, though the man himself was completely wet, disclosed to the toiling Deckard the eagerness of his face, bent low over the box of the compass, and the attentive stare of his eyes. He knew now where he was, and he hoped to run the sinking lighter ashore in the shallow cove where the high, cliff-like end of the Great Isabel is divided in two equal parts by a deep and overgrown ravine. Deckard pumped without intermission. Nostromo steered without relaxing for a second the intense, peering effort of his stare. Each of them was as if utterly alone with his task. It did not occur to them to speak. There was nothing in common between them, but the knowledge that the damaged lighter must be slowly but surely sinking. And that knowledge, which was like the crucial test of their desires, they seemed to have become completely estranged, as if they had discovered in the very shock of the collision that the loss of the lighter would not mean the same thing to them both. This common danger brought their differences in aim, in view, in character, and in position, into absolute prominence in the private vision of each. There was no bond of conviction, of common idea. They were merely two adventurers pursuing each his own adventure, involved in the same imminence of deadly peril. Therefore they had nothing to say to each other. But this peril, this only incontrovertible truth in which they shared, seemed to act as an inspiration to their mental and bodily powers. There was certainly something almost miraculous in the way the Capitas made the cove with nothing but the shadowy hint of the island's shape, and the vague gleam of a small sandy strip for a guide. Where the ravine opens between the cliffs, and a slender shallow rivulet meanders out of the bushes, to lose itself in the sea, the lighter was run ashore, and the two men, with a taciturn, undaunted energy, began to discharge her precious freight, carrying each ox-hide box up the bed of the rivulet beyond the bushes to a hollow place which the caving in of the soil had made below the roots of a large tree. Its big smooth trunk leaned like a fallen column far over the trickle of water running amongst the loose stones. A couple of years before, Nostromo had spent a whole Sunday, all alone, exploring the island. He explained this to Deckard after their task was done, and they sat, weary in every limb, with their legs hanging down the low bank, and their backs against the tree, like a pair of blind men aware of each other, and their surroundings by some indefinable sixth sense. "Yes," Nostromo repeated, "I never forget a place I have carefully looked at once." He spoke slowly, almost lazily, as if there had been a whole leisurely life before him, instead of the scanty 2 hours before daylight. The existence of the treasure, barely concealed in this improbable spot, laid a burden of secrecy upon every contemplated step, upon every intention and plan of future conduct. He felt the partial failure of this desperate affair entrusted to the great reputation he had known how to make for himself. However, it was also a partial success. His vanity was half appeased. His nervous irritation had subsided. "You never know what may be of use," he pursued with his usual quietness of tone and manner. I spent a whole miserable Sunday in exploring this crumb of land." "A misanthropic sort of occupation," muttered Deckard, viciously. "You had no money, I suppose, to gamble with, and to fling about amongst the girls, in your usual haunts, Capitas." "Evero!" exclaimed the Capitas, surprised into the use of his native tongue by so much perspicacity. I had not. Therefore I did not want to go amongst those beggarly people accustomed to my generosity. It is looked for from the Capitas of the Cargadores, who are the rich men, and, as it were, the caballeros amongst the common people. I don't care for cards, but as a pastime, And as to those girls that boast of having opened their doors to my knock, you know I wouldn't look at any one of them twice except for what the people would say. They are queer, the good people of Sulaco, and I have got much useful information simply by listening patiently to the talk of the women that everybody believed I was in love with. Poor Teresa could never understand that. On that particular Sunday, Senor, she scolded so that I went out of the house swearing that I would never darken their door again, unless to fetch away my hammock and my chest of clothes. Senor, there is nothing more exasperating than to hear a woman you respect rail against your good reputation, when you have not a single brass coin in your pocket. I untied one of the small boats, and pulled myself out of the harbor with nothing but three cigars in my pocket, to help me spend the day on this island. But the water of this rivulet you hear under your feet is cool, and sweet and good, Senor, both before and after a smoke. He was silent for a while, then added reflectively, that was the first Sunday, after I brought down the white-whiskered English Rico all the way down the mountains from the Paramo on the top of the Entrada Pass, and in the coach too. No coach had gone up or down that mountain road within the memory of man, Senor, till I brought this one down in charge of 50 peons working like one man with ropes, pickaxes, and poles under my direction. That was the rich Englishman who, as people say, pays for the making of this railway. He was very pleased with me. But my wages were not due till the end of the month. He slid down the bank suddenly. Deckard heard the splash of his feet in the brook, and followed his footsteps down the ravine. His form was lost among the bushes till he had reached the strip of sand under the cliff. As often happens in the Gulf, when the showers during the first part of the night had been frequent and heavy, the darkness had thinned considerably towards the morning, though there were no signs of daylight as yet. The cargo lighter, relieved of its precious burden, rocked feebly, half afloat, with her forefoot on the sand. A long rope stretched away like a black cotton thread across the strip of white beach to the grapnel Nostromo had carried ashore, and hooked to the stem of a tree-like shrub in the very opening of the ravine. There was nothing for Deckard but to remain on the island. He received from Nostromo's hands whatever food the foresight of Captain Mitchell had put on board the lighter, and deposited it temporarily in the little dinghy which on their arrival they had hauled up out of sight amongst the bushes. It was to be left with him. The island was to be a hiding place, not a prison. He could pull out to a passing ship. The OSN Company's mail boats passed close to the islands when going into Sulaco from the north. But the Minerva, carrying off the ex-president, had taken the news up north of the disturbances in Sulaco. It was possible that the next steamer down would get instructions to miss the port altogether, since the town, as far as the Minerva's officers knew, was for the time being in the hands of the rabble. This would mean that there would be no steamer for a month, as far as the mail service went, but Deckard had to take his chance of that. The island was his only shelter from the proscription hanging over his head. The Capitas was, of course, going back. The Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.